Good afternoon. We will open today's hearing or committee on public safety. Today is May 23rd, 2017. We have a public hearing that we are continuing on House Bill 5015, Department of Justice. And I believe we are picking up at the Division of Child Support. And so if Kate Cooper Richardson, come on up and bring whoever you would like to bring. We're seeing a lot of you today.
Bring me my boss.
Excellent. Take it away. And if you're following along or were not with us yesterday, a reminder that we're actually, the presentation that we're reviewing is on yesterday's date on OLIS. And so we're picking up, I believe, at slide 60. Is that correct?
Right.
Fred Boss, co-chairs, members of the subcommittee. My name is Fred Boss. I am the Deputy Attorney General. Would you like me to just tick down the presentations that you will have this afternoon?
That would be fantastic.
As you stated, the first presentation will be on the Division of Child Support Collections. Then we will have key performance measures, budget reduction options, policy option packages, and technical adjustments, and then winding up with pending legislation. And now I'd like to turn it over to the Director of the Division of Child Support.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Winters and Stark, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Cooper Richardson. I'm the director of the Oregon Child Support Program in the Department of Justice. And yes, we are starting on page 60, and I included just some slides you saw last time. I'll just for context, and I will then hop over those. This says all the wonderful things we do, and then highlight what we're going to talk about today. As Ms. Ross already mentioned, we're going to talk a little bit about collections and liquidated and delinquent debt. We've been asked to talk about that since a big portion or a pretty big portion of the DOJ liquidated and delinquent debt comes from the child support program. We'll talk a little bit about our key performance measures and then briefly about the policy packages before you. Okay, bear with me, please, because this is somewhat confusing. I'm trying to make it as clear as possible. So the Division of Child Support portion, as I said, of DOJ's reported delinquent debt results from two different areas. One of those is assigned child support. That means child support that's been assigned to the state. The rights to it are assigned to the state. And then division receivables, things that are due directly to the division. We'll talk a little bit more about both of these. But assigned support is child support that is temporarily assigned to the government. And so when I say the government, I mean state and federal government, when state services or public assistance is provided on behalf of a child. And then the receivables are funds that are due to the DOJ when someone's received a payment or a credit inappropriately. You can see the big numbers there. Okay. So assigned child support, this is what we're going to talk about first, the temporarily assigned to the government. This is a federally dictated part of the child support program, and it's based on public assistance status, and mostly that's going to be TANF. It can be Medicaid as well. It is for support collection. It is the last priority for support collection. So that, again, is mandated by federal regulations for the child support program. Current support and past due support are due to the family are paid before the past due to the state, so that can be many years down the road. It takes legal actions to establish or modify support orders, and so that also postpones collections. So while orders are in process, arrears can accrue. Payers often start out with a past due balance. However, the program has made some changes recently to set the limit on the amount of past due support that will be taken. And finally, the debtor often lacks the ability to pay. When public assistance is involved, both parents usually have a very similar financial status, and there are caps on the percentage of income that can be collected overall. So you're limited at 50% of a wage, and there's also caps on a percentage of income that can be collected overall. So when we have an income withholding for instance, and there's arrears on a case, and also current support due, we collect 100% of that current support due comes in first, and then there's a 20%, 120% of that current support amount that's helped paying down the arrears.
Okay, question on the ability to pay. Is a percentage of those individuals who are incarcerated?
Co-chair Co-chair Stark and Co-chair Winters, yes. And you may be thinking of the bill we were just talking about in the House Judiciary Committee too. But and I'm sorry that some of you have to see so much of me today. Yes, indeed. And I will say that the expiration of judgment, or essentially the statute of limitations, if you will, on child support, is 35 years. And that's 35 years from the date of the youngest child's emancipation. So that can be, if there's a child attending school, it can be 57 years. So these are very old debts, can be. And there was a time period where child support collections weren't, or child support orders were not based on ability to pay. They were just very high amounts. But that are not collectible. And some of those did accrue while people were incarcerated, which, of course, incarceration will reduce an ability to pay.
Thank you.
The funding types here, other funds that are due, you'll see in the pie here, the other funds that are due to DOJ, so that's that $104 million, the green-gray slice of the pie, that's the only portion that could be retained if collected. Like I said, it could be very, very old, and the likelihood of collection is tends to be quite small. The other funds, the federal funds, pass through as assistance reimbursement for other agencies. Some of that is actually federal, too. And then the federal funds pass through that we send back. So the federal government would take 66% of those funds. They fund us 2-to-1. When we collect on anything that's government assigned, they also would receive that amount. So where do the collections go? This just is a little visual here. Most of the collections, this has been a philosophy change in the program at the national level, but also in Oregon. State law requires that we pass through, even if someone's on TANF or receiving public assistance, requires that we pass through child support that's ordered to them up to $200 per family, $50 per child. So even if they're receiving public assistance, there is still funding that goes to the child as well. And there's a lot of research that supports that is actually a better way to help families get off public assistance and become self-sustaining and self-sufficient. So the collections to families have been going up. That's actually one of the KPMs we'll be talking about. But collections to federal and state agencies have been going down. Part of that is because it's the last debt to be collected. Another reason is that our TANF caseloads have been shrinking over time. And so that's anticipated to continue. Essentially, the child support program, the national and state, is moving away from a cost recovery program to be more a self-sufficiency program. So assigned support prevention and collection. So this is what we're doing, just so you know, to reduce the creation of new debts and also to increase payments on those debts that are collectible. Preventing non-payment, we're processing... we're making modifications to right-size the orders, so they're based on ability to pay. We're spending more time in customer engagement. There's a lot of research that supports that. But working with the customers in person, telephone, improving contact access and options really helps increase actually collection, and also more automation of the easy cases, if you will, through our child support system project, so that we have more time to focus on those harder to collect cases. Removing barriers also is an important part of collecting, and research and common experience really show that by engaging with the parents who pay support to engage with their family actually helps with their children, actually helps increase support for those children. We have access and visitation assistance, and we have an online parenting plan on the OJD website. We've had some mediator support in parenting time. Again, that involvement with their children helps increase collections and remove some of those barriers for them. We've given a lot of... we've made it easier to pay. We have cash kiosks. We have payments online. We take debit and credit cards and electronic check payments now. And the count of cases that we have that have arrears has decreased by 2.8%. That's almost 4,500 cases. And we're developing criteria for debt compromise and write-off. It's not something we've really had in the past. Many of these debts aren't collectible. We're in the process of developing criteria for those so that we can write off the debt that is never going to be coming in, or work with the other party have a satisfaction situation, whether they might forgive some of the debt in exchange for a lump sum. That's one example. And then, of course, we have our child support system project Origin, and we're doing more. There'll be more automated tools within that to help us locate debtors and locate assets. So this is the summary on assigned support. So really what's behind there. The amount assigned to the government, again, state and federal, changes as families move on and off assistance. So it's temporarily assigned as the families go off qualifying assistance. And they may do this multiple times during the life of these long lives of these child support cases. The accrued debt reassigns to the family. Any debt that exceeds the actual assistance for the child reassigns to the family, and that reassigned debt remains with the family even if they go back on assistance. Like I mentioned before, our assigned caseload's declining rapidly because of that federal policy changes and focusing first on poverty reduction and stability. The portion of our collections, more than $1 million a year, is just, as I said, passed through to the family. And the Deficit Reduction Act of 2009 and corresponding state legislation resulted in that pass-through up to $200 per family per month. It's similar to a monthly compromise payments reduce the amount due, but they're not kept by the government. So only the portion equal to the actual assistance may be retained despite the assignment of the full amount. So when they go off assistance, it goes away. My bottom line, it's a very deceptive figure. It changes daily, in fact, with people going on and off assistance. So any questions on assigned support collections? Okay, I'll move on to receivables then. And this is more of the classic sort of funds that are due to us at DOJ when an individual receives maybe an overpayment or a credit inappropriately. Those division receivables also can be quite old as well. What contributes to that, we have a federal two-day distribution timeline. So when we get the money in by federal law, we have to get it out within 2 days. And so sometimes you don't know. We haven't had time to find out if it's a dishonored payment or not. We have also had in recent years more, as you all know, more fraud with IRS tax refunds. And so we've had reversed offsets. We do we have the ability to offset from state and federal tax returns. And if that is reversed later because of fraud, the money's already been dispersed. So we do have to, it becomes a receivable.
Kate, has there any conversation or dialogue with the federal government and other states about addressing that two-day turnaround issue?
Co-Chair Stark, Co-Chair Winters, I'll say no. the two-day turnaround is actually a very important to families living on the edge of poverty. So when that money comes in, we need to get that money to the families as soon as possible. There, if we're holding on to it longer, that actually can create a hardship for those who are living paycheck to paycheck.
Another, since that is a federal requirement, another question then, what is the amount of uncollectibles?
Of uncollectible debt?
Mm-hmm.
Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters, it's difficult to say right now exactly what is considered uncollectible. We are, as I said, developing a write-off process right now, and we don't have all the data available in our current system that we will have in our future system. But we do have some information on how it's how old the debt is, and I'm going to look at my my manager who takes care of this to say if you were going to ballpark it.
Mm-hmm. We have debts back to 1992.
We have debts back to 1992 that are likely uncollectible.
Well, I would say if it's back to 92,
yeah.
But you do have enough on your books to know that. Let's say within 60 days it hasn't been collected, 90 days it hasn't been collected, a year that hasn't been collected.
Right.
I mean, 92, with all probability, it's...
Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters, however, what this isn't capturing is are those who are making payments against it. So they may be making payments on it, but that doesn't mean it's uncollectible. It's just that the full amount may be uncollectible. And
so you don't separate the categories out. I see the difference between that which is uncollectible and that which you, and what you have on a payment contract or people that are actually trying.
Co-chairs, we aren't able to have as many data points as we want, but we do we can track how many have had payments, and that is the information we're using for that write-off process to determine what is uncollectible and that can be written.
If you're in business, you've got to have the accounting to where you do have an uncollectible category.
Co-chairs, and you're exactly right, Senator Winters. We do. And we do have... We do write off some state debt. We can't write off someone else's debt. And most of this debt is owed to the families. But those are some of the ways that we are working with the parties in a case. As I demonstrated earlier, much of this debt is not due to us. It's due to the other parent.
I'm trying to check, because I thought you said that you will issue a check to the family,
mm-hmm.
and some of these are where, let's say, that the check that came in, and that check was an NSF check.
Right.
And so then that goes into, I would think, a separate account over here of debt owing now to the state, not to the family.
Indeed, co-chairs. And yes, we're kind of talking about both things. We've got the assigned child support debt and then the receivables debt. And you're exactly right. On the receivables debt, that is owed back to the department.
So,
and we are developing the write-off process for that. But we do recover. We do have a recovery process for that.
So how much is that?
That is $5 million. Okay, I understand better the question you were asking now. Thanks.
So we've got $5 million that's owed to us out there, dating probably all the way back to 92. Is that right?
That's correct.
Not all of it. But.
No, but, I mean, the oldest debt is probably 92.
Indeed. And Co-Chair Stark and Winters.
Do you turn those over to Department of Revenue?
Yes, we do. We do. And I'm going to go on to the next slide because you're leading me right there. So here's what we do to prevent the new debts. Those tax refunds that do get reversed after 6 months, we hold those do get reversed after they've been dispersed. We now hold those offsets for 6 months, and we have worked this out with the IRS. All child support programs have done that, where we hold them instead of for 6 months, those funds, and after 6 months we are able to disperse them and be held harmless. It used to be that the IRS would say, give us back the money, and even if it had gone out to the family, they would hold the programs responsible for that. That's no longer the case, so that the receivables arising from that have really diminished. We have a positive pay process, which means that we're verifying all issued checks before they're paid. We have fees for dishonored payments now, and that helps to discourage repeats, and we'll hold future payments if we've had a dishonored payment. So in going to increasing collections on that, we do have developed a process and a procedure, and we use first at our level off-the-shelf product, PIMS, the Portfolio Inventory Management System. It's also used by the private sector. We use that process for our receivables. We have automated collection letters. After 90 days unpaid, it goes to the Department of Revenue for collection. And then after the Department of Revenue, we have private collection through Professional Credit Services, which is with the Haas Financial Group.
How long does the Department of Revenue actually time that they have before they turn those over to private collections?
I believe they have been through the collection. Sometimes we'll run debts through the collection process twice, and
one year.
Because the longer a debt stays, the harder it is to collect.
Absolutely.
So you've got about a year and a quarter before it's turned over to the private sector for collection, or a year and a half?
Co-Chair Stark and Winters, yes, that is the case. But we have worked on it first. So we have our own collection base, so we work on it first. If it's not paid after 90 days, and we do collect from there, it does work. Then those uncollected go to Department of Revenue. They're there for 1 year, then after that is to the private collection. Does that answer your question?
It answers my question. It doesn't stop my brain from running around as how long, you know, the longer debt is owed, the more difficult it is to collect. And I wondered why we've given the Department of Revenue a year, with which you've done yours in 90 days, and Department of Revenue has a year, and they have access to a lot of tools with which to collect before those are turned over.
Co-Chair Stark and Winters, Senator Winters, that 1 year time period allows for that state tax offset period, and that is a very effective collection tool for us.
I started this whole collection thing back in 99, and I would hope by now that we were doing a much faster, better job than the amount that's being owed to the state that has not been collected. I'm not just talking about your agency, because there's a lot more out there than yours. Yours is probably doing better than most.
Co-Chair Winters, of course I would like to say that's true, and I think it is in many, many cases, because that is the business in which we are in. We do collect support, and so we do know how to also collect our receivables as well. And just a couple of other things we're looking to do in the future is with our new system project that we have putting in place, we're develop some metrics and business intelligence that's robust enough to allow monthly monitoring, so that our goal is never to get it to the Department of Revenue. Our goal is to recover it ourselves. We are also reassigning those collections from our accounting staff to our special collections team. So those who have the expertise in collecting child support, same principles apply. So that's the information that I have on the liquidated and delinquent debt and our collections. Are there any more questions on that? All right, I'll turn to our performance measures then. We have, just as a reminder, the child support programs federally are in all 50 states and the territories as well, are performance-based. There are five federal performance measures that we are we must meet and or we must be working toward. And these are them listed here. Some of these are also Oregon KPMs. And then there is one performance measure I alluded to earlier that is an Oregon-only performance measure. So I'm going to walk through those quickly. This is the percentage of collected support distributed to families. And this is the state KPM that's an Oregon-specific one. It actually in some ways works at cross purposes with another performance measure, but we can talk about that a little bit more. But this really is focused on a reinvestment in families in Oregon. So the reduction of state assigned collections. So at the close of a federal fiscal year, last year, so at the end of September of last year, 91.8% of the total support collected was distributed to families. So what we collect, the percentage of child support that's collected, 92%, almost 92% of that goes out directly to families. It's not retained by the state. And that's an increase of almost 0.5% when compared to the same time frame in the previous federal fiscal year.
How does that compare with other states?
Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters, you know, frankly, I think from the... I think we fall in right in the ballpark. I think the national figure is about 93%. National figure is about 93%. So we're right in that range. It's not considered a federal performance measure, but it is something that is tracked. You know, we're still below our targeted 93%, and payments to state debt comprise about 6.5% of the total support distributed. So that's a decrease compared to the previous federal fiscal year. So it's trending in the right directions. So we've had an average increase of $2.9 million a year over the last few years. Performance measure 137.11 is the percent of current child support collected relative to the current support owed. So this is actually a very difficult. This is a difficult performance measure, and we actually rank kind of right in the middle with most of the other states. So at the close of the federal fiscal year last year, we reported a total of $432 million and some change in current support that was due, and then we had $270 million and change collected. So that's we're collecting at about a little over 61%. So this year's performance increased by about 1.3%, although that's not necessarily due to more collections, but it's really due to an overall reduction in the total amount of current support that's due. So actually current support has been shrinking as it's become right-sized. So its support must be based on an ability to pay. Like I said, over the last few decades, there's been a shift in how support is determined. And so it's now based on ability to pay. And so when we go through the guidelines and attach that ability to pay, it has resulted in overall smaller current support orders.
Is that due to the economy?
Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters, partly, because it is due to what folks are earning. So as as wages have not increased greatly, that is true. It also is attributable to the fact that there used to be current support orders that were unrealistically high. Much greater percentage of someone's income, wasn't attached to the ability to pay. Those have since been adjusted, and because the federal guidelines require that ability to pay, and Oregon's long been there on the forefront with that as well, that's part of why those current support orders have been shrinking. So we only one state, I want to just make clear here, only one state in the nation reaches the federal benchmark on this, and that's Pennsylvania. And the next closest state is Wisconsin at 74%. So it is, and this can vary widely across the nation, but there's a cluster of us all right there in the middle.
What does Pennsylvania do differently?
Okay. Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters. I have to be careful how I answer this question, because there among the directors, we are all rather suspicious of what Pennsylvania does and whether they're within the guidelines the federal government lays out. They have a different sort of caseload. They close cases very, very quickly. And no state has been able to replicate their approach. That's the most diplomatic way of putting it.
Nicely done.
You can read a lot into that, Katie.
I leave that to the committee. Let's see. I'm moving on to the percentage of cases paying toward arrears relative to the total arrears. So this is the number of arrears cases that open at the number of arrears cases that we had that were open at the close of the fourth quarter. You can see that this is a cumulative measure here. So it's really best to look at the trend line and where we've ended up each federal fiscal year. So cases with arrears are dispersed throughout our program, and about 80% of them reside with the Division of Child Support and about 20% with the DA offices, who are also under our umbrella here for the Child Support program. The count of cases with arrears has decreased, I mentioned earlier, by 2.8%. And this is actually this is measuring a payment on arrears, that there is not the amount of the payment, but the payment on arrears. And the performance is demonstrated over the previous 5 years here, and it just shows an overall trend in performance, so we're slightly increasing over that. Again, we are kind of clustered there with many other states, and only one state meets the federal benchmark. Any guesses?
Start with a P.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Pennsylvania. And the next closest is Vermont, but that's at 75%. So, again. This is the percentage of cases with support orders relative to the total cases. So before, and I think we talked about this last time I was here, before you can have any child support, you have to have an order for child support. Before you can have an order for child support, you have to have paternity established, and because you have to have the legal parent to provide that support. So that is one of the federal performance measures. And for us, 86.5% of the cases had orders. We've really improved, as you can see here by the graph, that we've really improved over the last few years. We had an increase of performance of 2.8%, and we're exceeding our program goal of 75%, and also the federal benchmark of 80%. Maine is the top performing program in that with 95%. But there's a lot of variance state by state, because many states have a caseload with a high amount of TANF cases, cases that are getting assistance, and some states have a very small percentage of their caseload. Oregon is actually one of the states with a higher caseload with public assistance, and most of those cases, all of those cases come in without an order in the first place. So we have to establish that order. I'm very proud of this, by the way. Our staff are rocking this performance measure. And then last thing I just will mention quickly, you have the materials here before you, but we do have two packages here, a revenue reduction restoration. This kind of is talking about how we have a decreasing pool on which to collect for recoveries and fund some of our own positions. And so that package is here before you, as is our child support system project, which we've talked with you numerous times in the past. And these are just, I won't go over these, but this is kind of the consequences of not filling our revenue restoration package. It does decrease our performance and our ability to support families. Likewise, here's the consequence of that reduction for the other funds. We lose, of course, the federal match. And then I just, very briefly, the child support system project. All states, as you know, have to maintain an automated system, and we are in the middle of a very extensive project to replace our automated system. And this project is just, this package is just to continue the our, if you so choose to fund through bonds, to extend the project through this biennium. We are at the height of the work on, we're well into development now. Things are going very well. Our federal, in fact, I have to brag on the record here, our federal partners who were just here on oversight, we have to meet federal certifications for a federal certification of this system, and they have been here on, and have an independent contractor looking over our program or our project. And I was very pleased that not only with us in person, but also at a national meeting, federal systems person, oversight person has said that things are going very well and they're holding up Oregon's project as a model for other states who are embarking on this as well. So that was great news to hear. We plan to continue on that pathway, but this is the request for that.
Kate, because this project is probably new to some members on the board. It's not new to those who've been here on this panel. Can you talk a little bit about, and I want to go back because you had on the one slide the increased cost, and I think it was gas and I'm talking about the cost of the automated project now. So let's see.
The overall cost,
mm-hmm. and you had identified both the risk of not funding, and you also had the project cost increases. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think Co-Chair Stark and Co-Chair Winters. I think that maybe Art has the actual numbers of that.
The
change, but I'm happy to talk about the project overall. It's about $130 million project. We are in as it was through the feasibility study, right here, the feasibility study report, and when we came forward, that those were the numbers that we knew at that time. We are entering now into the period where we are in development, and so some of the knowns and some of the unknowns are becoming knowns, including federal regulation changes, and I mentioned some of those in our House Judiciary Committee today. Those have to be incorporated, and any legislative changes here at the state level have to be incorporated into the project. And some of the things that we knew would be, we didn't know the cost of those. What's the best word here? The cost of those, that functionality, are now becoming more known. So we have had some change orders, as are to be expected. We've been following within the system projects an average expectation of what it would be expected with a IT project. And so I would say, in fact, I think the federal government said this as well, is that what they're seeing come forward is what was been expected. They, of course, are paying 2/3 of the costs. And so we have adjusted our deliverables at certain times as we have more knowns. We've been financing through bonds, and so we have adjusted both up and down at various periods to only issue bonds for the amount that we expect in that period.
I think this particular legislator would like to see a day when we've got an IT project that comes in with not having these cost overruns and that actually delivers what they say that they're going to do. I mean, it's actually where it's become for some of us who've sat through some of this for years that it's a rarity. Mm-hmm. It's an absolute rarity that we get, you know, and I think we hired, now we've got the big guru now that we actually, and I understand that, to work with agencies and what have you so that we can get better IT project. I think maybe I'm in the wrong business. I probably should have, when I was younger, become an IT specialist or something.
Yeah.
Co-chair Stark, co-chair Winters, you're welcome to come join our project if you'd like.
No,
I will say,
no. Right. No, there's not time.
Okay, well, I will say that this is where I plan, it's all of our expectation. The Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, and the full Department just expects that this project will be one of those projects that meet your expectations. The adjustments here that you're seeing in costs are not considered cost overruns. These fall within the expected variance for any project at a certain point in time. And so we have kept our pencils very, very sharp, working with our contractors, and they know they're working with the Department of Justice to make sure that any changes, and some of those are changes we request, not the contractor, and in this case here, the implementation contractor is Deloitte. So we work very hard to contain those. We've deferred some things so we don't have increase our costs up front, and I plan to meet those expectations, Senator Winters.
I do hope so. I'm looking at Mr. Borden too. He's got a very sharp pencil over in this.
And Co-Chair Winters, I will say we work very, very closely with LFO, and we know how sharp his pencil is, and we share his commitment to a sharp pencil. Any other questions or comments?
Madam Chair.
Yes. Oh.
Just quickly, Mr. Chair. Who has the gavel today anyway?
I wouldn't know.
Is Bob Cummings mm-hmm. working directly with you on the project?
Co-Chair Stark and Winters, Representative Huffman, yes, yes he is.
Okay, thank you.
And he smiles.
Bob or me?
Both. Anything else?
All right. We will next have Art Ehr, our Chief Financial Officer, speak about our key performance measures and budget reduction options.
Good afternoon.
Yes.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Stark and Winters and members of the committee. My name is Art Ehr. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Oregon Department of Justice, and I will give you a high-level overview of our key performance measures. Kate has already talked about some of them, so I think that will save us a little time. Here's a slide showing all 16 of our key performance measures, organized by their current status for 2016. We have 11 of them in what's called the green range, within 5% of their approved targets, 4 of them in the yellow range, between 6% and 15% off of their targets, and then 1 in the red range, which is more than 15% off of its target. I'll go through each of them individually, and as I say, I'll be brief on some of those already touched upon. Actually, I'll be brief on all of them. Focusing most of my comments on those in the yellow and red ranges, because I think that would be where you're probably most concerned or interested. I should note also that it's my understanding that the targets are being reevaluated by the Legislative Fiscal Office, and there could be one or more recommended changes to the targets for the coming biennium. So this shows the first five, numbers 1 through 5. KPM number 1 is the percentage of our legal cases in which the state's position is upheld. The data come from 4 of our divisions, appellate, civil enforcement, general counsel, and trial divisions. The target increased from 92% in 2015 to 95% in 2016, and we met that target in 2016. KPM number 2 is the percentage of cases deemed appropriate for resolution through negotiation and settlement that are actually resolved through negotiation and settlement rather than going to trial. The data again come from those 4 divisions that I mentioned earlier, and the target increased from 55% in 2015 to 60% in 2016, and we met that target in 2016. KPM number 3 is the dollar value of monies recovered for the state divided by the cost of recovery. In 2016, we received an $11.5 million punitive damages award, and these awards are rather rare, and we expect that they will become rarer in the future, more rare, rarer in the future, very unlikely in the future, put it that way. We did meet the target of $25 per of monies recovered for every dollar that we spent on that recovery. KPM number four is the number of working days from the receipt of a contract sent to us for legal review to our first substantive response to the agency. And Steve Wolf from our general counsel division talked about this yesterday. We took an average of 1.5 day longer than the target, and I think Steve Wolf spoke somewhat to that yesterday in his remarks. We have had some additional complexity in cases and a large number of cases and also resource issues there, but we're very close to being on target. We are, however, in the yellow range. KPM number five is the percentage of legal billings receivables collected within 30 days. We're in green territory, but just slightly below the target. The main reasons for delay in getting these receivables collected is questions about our billings and arguing agencies that we've billed arguing against some of the charges in our bills. Moving on to KPM 6 through 10, KPM number 6 is the percentage of timely and completed, timely and complete charities reports submitted to us relative to the total charities registered. We've seen a large increase in the number of charities registered with the state. I think it's up in the 19,000 range at this point, and a slight decline over the last few years in the percentage of reports submitted timely and completed. So we are in the yellow range there, but just a little bit below the target. KPM number seven is the standard customer satisfaction survey or the results from that survey on several measures. Now, what we are showing here on this slide is the result for the overall satisfaction. There are several other measures, and I'll show you a slide right at the end of this segment of my presentation that shows the historical trend in all of the components, such as timeliness and accuracy and so forth. We sent survey invitations to 878 people in the most recent survey. Across all state agencies, including multiple people in our client agencies, we received 247 responses for a 28% response rate. We met the 95% target on all of the individual components as well as the overall. Some of the individual components were above 95% in the it doesn't say there, but that is in the essentially the good or excellent results on that survey, satisfaction survey. KPM number eight is the percentage of Criminal Justice Division cases resolved successfully. The target increased from 98% in 2015 to 99% in 2016. We did meet that target, and you know, it's a very high percentage. KPM number nine is the percentage of crime victims' compensation orders that are issued within 90 days of receipt of the claim. The target increased from 90% in 2015 to 98% in 2016. We were slightly under that target, but still within the green range. And then KPM number 10 is the percentage of support collected by the child support, and this was mentioned earlier. So KPM number 10, 11, 12, and 13 were all related to Division of Child Support, and Kate just talked about them. KPM number 10 is the percentage of support collected by the child support program that is distributed to families. We're just barely under the target and in the green range with a slight improvement over the prior 4 years. KPM number 11 is the percentage of current, that is on time, child support collected relative to the total child support owed. The results improved to 63% in 2016. That's above the target and higher than in the prior 4 years. KPM number 12 is the percentage of child support program cases paying toward arrears out of those owing arrears, and the results improved to 61% from as low as 57% in recent years, still below the 65% target. Improvement in the economy is helping this KPM. KPM number 13 is the percentage of child support program cases with support orders out of the total number of cases. The target increased from 75% in 2015 to 80% in 2016. We exceeded that target, and part of that improvement recently was related to caseload cleanup, data cleanup, essentially. Moving on to the last three, KPM number 14 is the percentage of adult crime victims leaving domestic violence shelters with a safety plan after a stay of 5 or more days. We fell short of the 100% target and are in the yellow range. Still, 92% is pretty good. Nevertheless, DOJ makes grants to support domestic violence shelters, which are private nonprofits. So we don't have direct control over that outcome, but we do support the organizations that are intermediaries to achieving that outcome. KPM number 15 is the percentage of sexual assault exams that are conducted by specially trained sexual assault nurse examiners. DOJ administers the Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Medical Response Fund. The acronym is SAVE, S-A-V-E. And that helps offset the cost, that fund helps offset the cost of training the nurses, the sexual assault nurse examiners, and helps offset the cost of training, of the sexual assault exams themselves. The nurses, the nurse examiners, the specially trained nurse examiners are employed by healthcare providers. So again, we don't have direct control over them. We help fund their training and the actual exams that they do, but we don't have direct control over the individuals who provide that that service. And finally, KPM, and that one is in red territory. As I mentioned, the target is 85%. The result was 69%. KPM number 16 is the percentage of defense of criminal conviction cases that are briefed within 210 days. The target increased from 90% in 2015 to 95% in 2016. We fell slightly below the target and within the green range, and we did that by managing our resources. So finally, the slide that shows the standard, I think most agencies have this performance measure, customer satisfaction. Measure the percentage of respondents who say that our customer service is good or excellent on various measures such as accuracy, availability of information, expertise, helpfulness, timeliness, and then an overall measure. We met or exceeded the 95% target in every one of those measures. Our overall measure was 95%, but there were three of them that were slightly above the 95% measure, those being accuracy, expertise, and helpfulness. And as I said, we had 247 responses on our survey. That was a 28% response rate. So that concludes my measure, my comments on key performance measures. If there are any questions on that, I'd be happy to take those at this time or move on to our budget reduction options.
Any questions? Nope.
All right. I will now talk about budget reduction options. Like all agencies, we develop budget reduction options as part of our agency request budget. Then during the development of the governor's budget, other reduction options were identified, and then following the governor's budget, at least one additional option emerged. In reexamining our mandated caseload projections for the Defense of Criminal Convictions casework, we identified about $4.6 million of general fund savings while still providing what we believe is adequate funding for this critical work. In reexamining our billed hour rate for legal services during the development of the governor's budget, we identified several ways to reduce the rate to $185 per hour without jeopardizing our legal fund. Some of those savings were one-time savings, but nevertheless, we did get the rate down to $185 per hour. And that saves roughly $4.6 million general fund across all agencies in paying their DOJ legal bills. I'm not positive of the $4.6 million, but it's in that ballpark. That's a rough estimate. The governor's budget proposed a $5.1 million general fund reduction to the Crime Victim Services Division, which would take more than one half of the current level of general fund support from the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Program. That would result in a need to replace this funding in the following biennium and to add general fund sooner than otherwise to replace the division's punitive damages funding that would be diverted or used to backfill this general fund cut.
So I'm going to have you pause there. We have a question from Representative Barker, and then Mr. Borden has additional information on that.
Well, that's what I'll hear the additional information.
Okay. Will you kind of enlighten us to some of the details behind that and what the thought process is for that, please?
Mr. Co-Chair, I'm happy to do so, and members of the committee. that Crime Victim Services fund shift is the result of a $11.5 million one-time punitive damage award settlement with the Philip Morris Company. And so what the governor's budget did and what the co-chair's framework has done is take $5.1 million of that as a one-time fund shift, reducing general fund and replacing it with this punitive damage award for this 17-19 biennium. And what happens with a fund shift is that if it's one time in nature, next biennium, during 19 and 21 biennium, that fund shift will reverse itself and the general fund will return in place of the punitive damage awards. Right. So the important thing about this reduction, why it was taken in, I believe, in the governor's budget and why it's in the co-chair's framework is that it is not technically a reduction, it's a fund shift. So in absence of this, the agency and the program would have a general fund reduction. So in other words, it's relatively painless issue to capture some general fund savings. The checks still go out from the program to the various entities that receive the money. That's still continues, still in the same anticipated amount. So they would receive, there would be no impact there on the ground. So,
and so I'm going to repeat some of that in my own terminology here. So across the board, we were supposed to be looking for reduction efforts. So technically, this could be viewed as a reduction effort because it's bouncing out of that general fund. We understand very aware that the punitive damages fund is not something that we should be relying on long term, and that's why with a fund shift that it is expected will automatically revert back to general fund. So it's it doesn't run the same risk as other things that are normally dependent on it. This is a one time.
So on the ground it'll be no different. It's just like as if it was being funded, we're not shorting that division any money.
Mr.
Correct.
Co-chair, I misunderstood yes. that. I mean, because yes. I understood that going down the road here, they'd be taking a pretty big hit out of this. But that is not the case. Is what you're telling me.
Correct. If it was a permanent shift. Then that would be a different issue. But because it's this one biennium with the financial situation, and given that there is a settlement that came in that actually made funds available, that's why. Representative Sanchez.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So that part of my question is essentially, yes, only one time, we've got that pretty solid. Are we guaranteed that there's enough resource in that one-time little pot of money that we're talking about to cover this, and that we've got a solid just this one-time situation? Because
yes, so again, there was a bump, they mentioned it a little while ago, $11.5 million settlement that came through, so it was from that. And if you want to comment on the ongoing balance of that, is, to my understanding, sufficient to continue funding the ongoing obligations that that fund has. You can correct me if you or add to if you'd like to.
Just to follow up, I'm just always concerned that, you know, other people are looking at the same pot.
Yes.
To pull something from, and I just want to make sure that we're considering that, because as you're very aware, the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Act fund was never funded to where it needed to be. I mean, the original ask was $25 million almost 16 years ago, and we're still at a very, very low number. So I just want to make sure that we're seriously considering that nobody else is looking into that pot to sneak anything out, and that we're very clear that that fund is going to be, those funds are going to be available for domestic violence services throughout the state.
And I would respond with, we are very clear with the intent with that and the expectation that I can't guarantee that somebody's not going to ask, but that doesn't mean we would say yes.
Okay.
If you want to add anything on that?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, this is the, as far as Legislative Fiscal Office is aware, this is the only change to this punitive damage award, this large settlement. And also one thing I failed to mention was that the legislature in 2000, in this current biennium in 15-17, you know, at it, when the budget was being developed and approved by the legislature, this settlement was not known. There was a shortfall of about $2 million in punitive damages, and the legislature appropriated money to that to fill that void. So it's been a high priority of the legislature to make the program whole in this that respect. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Paluso.
I think my only comment is I'm really concerned about the word intention. That doesn't give a doesn't make me feel really that's just not a strong word. It's intended means that it could not, there's possible that it's not going to happen, and that causes me concern.
So that was a bad choice of words on my part then.
You know, well, what's the better word? But I also realize you probably can't promise me it.
Right.
So I mean, I am truly aware of that. But again, it is very difficult for me to sacrifice women who are crime victims. Mm-hmm. It's really really hard to make that all just. Make any sense to me in the reduction of funding in this particular you know, it's the Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force, it's the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services, it's a whole lot of stuff that in a year's time can impact many, many, many victims. So I will struggle with this from forever. So
and so I would like to comment when the word intention is the wrong term. We have not yet passed the budget, and therefore at this point I can say intent is until we pass a budget on this, we can only set what we are currently planning or hoping to get to. When the legislature passes the budget, we write out these are where we are designating where funds are going, and it's my understanding the current plan, unless the big co-chairs change something, is that this is how it would be done. And because we want to make sure that they do not take a reduction. So we are finding other funds that we weren't expecting that were made available to make sure it's fully funded and making sure that the terminology is written in a manner in which it automatically reverts back to general fund next time around.
I am well aware of that. Okay. I am well aware of that. Trust me. But again, I think you can feel the passion in the room mm-hmm. about this specific cause. So I take the opportunity to put on record my feelings about the decision.
All right. Okay. Other comments, questions?
And I would just add to that, in order for me to get to a yes vote, when the final product comes out, it has to have that in there.
Right.
For
yes,
me.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
There we have it.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Continuing, there was a recent settlement with tobacco manufacturers that allows us to discontinue expenditures on defending the master settlement agreement, saving $3.2 million of general fund for the coming biennium. And overall, when we take all of these various proposed reductions, that's about an 18% general fund savings from current service level. There are some additional savings, non-general fund, permanent expenditure limitation reductions of both federal funds and other funds that we've identified and provided that information to the Legislative Fiscal Office, and some position eliminations and additional vacancy savings. Two of those position reductions have no projected savings because in one case it's a shift of funds from personal services to services and supplies, and in another case it was a position that was intended to be in the budget but was inadvertently left out of the budget, and therefore it was legislatively intended to be there but it is not there, and we're obviously not going forward with that position, and it's a position that actually we do not need. There's also the potential for additional vacancy savings based on the possibility of reduced workload as other agencies have their budgets constrained.
I'm going to have you pause for just a second. So Mr. Borden has a clarification for us.
Okay.
LFO would just like to clarify that some of these items here are not in the governor's budget. These are under consideration.
Correct.
So thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification. I would like to turn now to our very brief overview of our policy option packages and technical adjustments. We are hoping to have the increase in the child welfare DHS representation package included, package 132, the continuation of the child support system project, as mentioned earlier by Kate Richardson, the continuation of the Criminal Justice Division's Fusion Center, the addition of a number of grant-funded positions in the Criminal Justice Division, an increase in the federal funds expenditure limitation for the Victims of Crime Act, the an expansion of three positions in the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit that's funded by both federal funds and Fraud Control Unit other fund recoveries, the addition of other fund expenditure limitation and one position for the public law conference to be held this coming fall, plus the position being a training coordinator position. Six positions in the General Counsel Division that are anticipated to be needed due to higher workload from workload demand from our client agencies. Additional limitation for ongoing expenses in our Information Services section. Reclassification of three positions and the addition of one position in our Budget section, and the addition of an Accounting Tech 2 position in our Financial Services section to shore up the workload issues there. In addition, we are looking for general fund backfill of $1.7 million for a projected other fund revenue shortfall in the Division of Child Support, the reclassification of four positions in our Crime Victim Services Division, the possibility of funding some statewide benefit legal work, and some additional funding for our ballot title review activities, and the addition of one position in the Criminal Justice Division for, this is an Oregon Department of Transportation funded position for driving under the influence of intoxicants prosecution, and ongoing support for our legal tools project that was mentioned earlier by at least Steve Wolf, talked about how that project will help us track our projects better. And a placeholder for jurisdictional work in several counties as they opt out of child advocacy jurisdictional work. Combined with the various reduction options identified earlier, the net effect is about a 12% reduction from DOJ's general fund at current service level. And I would point out that 5% of that is the projected general fund savings in other agencies due to a lower hourly billing rate. Required or requested technical adjustments. We are asking to have $1.2 million of other fund expenditure limitation extended into the next biennium because of a slower than anticipated implementation of our legal tools project. So we had that limitation in this biennium, but we didn't actually move forward fast enough with that project. And so we are continuing to move forward with that in the next biennium and need that limitation in that biennium. It does not affect the billing rate because we already built that, the revenue generation for that project into the current biennium, and so that revenue would shift over into the next biennium to fund that. We are requesting two additional positions in our civil enforcement division. As I mentioned earlier, there was a recent settlement with the tobacco manufacturers, and part of that settlement requires us to add some compliance specialist one positions, and so this is a request for those positions. We are requesting the addition of missing personal services expenditure limitation for a paralegal position, again in our civil enforcement division. And it was mentioned earlier, just earlier today, the updated figures for the child support project, the CSIS project, the major IT project, and I have those numbers up there in front of you, the $300,000 roughly general fund for additional debt service, and then additional other fund and federal fund expenditure limitation for additional costs, mostly related to, as Kate, I believe, mentioned, changes in federal rules that require the project to meet those new standards. And then the elimination of our internal auditor position. We have shifted away from having an internal auditor, this was a few years ago, to contracting out for our internal auditing activities. We're actually undergoing an audit right now and looking forward to having that finalized very, very shortly. And so we're requesting to have that personal services be shifted over to professional services for that contracting. So that concludes my remarks on the reduction options, policy packages, and the technical adjustments. Any further questions on those?
Any questions? Mr. Borden?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, just for some clarification, especially on the next part that the agency will talk to, the way the budget process works, for example, the agency has a juvenile dependency policy package. Mm-hmm. That will be removed from the agency's primary budget measure because that that impact will go with this policy bill if the policy bill becomes law. And so you'll see that recommendation come through the process. And then if the juvenile dependency representation bill advances and comes through the process, the budgetary impact of that will be considered separately. So. And that's true for all of these policy measures that will come through. So just to kind of go back real quick for basics, when you finish the legislative session, you will have approved generally an agency's primary budget bill. They're kind of meat and potatoes. In addition to that will be any policy bills that have budgetary impact will be added to that. There'll be the end of session bills that do such things as DAS rate adjustments and the Attorney General rate adjustments. And other changes. The combined total of those for the agency is what the legislatively approved budget is. So right now you're looking at just this one sliver, which is the agency's primary budget measure. And as you kind of move through the remainder of the session, you'll start getting more flavor to that with the policy measures that are being considered. Thank you, Mr. Kutcher.
All right. Let's carry on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I believe up next we have a discussion of our pending, pending legislation that affects DOJ, and I believe our legislative coordinator, Aaron Knott, will provide that information.
Yes, he will.
Oh, sure. Mr. Knott did not want to.
Yeah.
Former judiciary lawyer, Aaron Knott.
Chair Stark, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice. We were asked to reserve a little time at the end of our presentation for a brief overview of the legislative proposals that we anticipate having some bearing on the Department of Justice. The first remark I'd make is that they're relatively voluminous. There were, and I mean, it's an easy joke to make since you're right there. Many of them were sponsored by the good co-chair. And what that demonstrated, not because he was targeting DOJ, but oh, at least I don't think so, but because we sort of get pulled in with bills that are primarily aimed at other agencies. To give an example, which is one that actually we were asked by the other co-chair to speak to on this record was House Bill 2500. House Bill 2500 was a bill that called upon the Department of Justice to assist caseworkers at the Department of Human Services with additional trainings. And again, I don't anticipate that bill would come through the public safety sub, and there are quite a few that are in that category. So for the sake of the sunny afternoon and my own sense of mercy, I'm going to make a fairly light touch on that.
So that bill has already passed the Senate.
Yes, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, I am aware. Okay. We were asked by your good other co-chair to offer some clarification as to why we didn't put a fiscal impact on that bill to this committee. So we'll get to that. In terms of the two most significant policy bills that I would draw to your attention this session, one you just heard about, which is House Bill 2345. That is the bill that will reconfigure the way that legal representation is handled within dependency cases within the Department of Human Services. That is the reason I asked Joanne Southey, the head of our Child Advocacy Division, to join me up here in case that one came up. For my part, I want to speak very briefly, and again, I'm meaning for this to be a flyover, not a deep dive, because I think I hope we'll have the opportunity, but to speak to the Attorney General's top legislative priority in this session, House Bill 2355, the so-called profiling bill. The profiling bill actually does three significant things. It's a complex bill, but there are three that I think are most relevant to the fiscal conversation. First of all, it reduces drug sentences from a Class C felony to Class A misdemeanor under certain circumstances. Secondly, it puts in place a statewide system for the collection of data about pedestrian and traffic stop interactions between law enforcement and our citizen population. And finally, it directs the Department of Public Safety Standards and Safety and Training to require every officer at every point in their career to receive some training in the prevention of profiling. This came out of the profiling task force, and we heard, and I think everyone in this room has heard, in that task force that only about one-third of our law enforcement has had the training that DPSST considers to be most relevant to the prevention of profiling. That is not their fault. That's a reflection of the fact that our conversation about profiling and our understanding of the root causes of profiling is relatively new. It's only been in effect for 8 to 10 years. DPSST was actually pretty early in the game about getting programs on the record. So just to give a very brief sense of what I think the large fiscal impacts will be, for the data collection, 21 other states have already engaged in some data collection provision, and so that gives us two advantages. Number one, we have a pretty good sense of what other states paid for it, and number two, we were able to draw on their expertise to identify federal resources that are available to offset those expenses. So we have already set out an RFI through DAS via OSP. Boy, that was a nightmare of a sentence. to try to get a sense of what the vendor community looks like to actually implement this program in a timely manner. We got quite a wealth of responses back, and the median response was a little under $500,000. In terms of federal money available for offset, and again, I will get into this in more detail in a future date. This is meant as sneak preview only. There are two federal pots that are available to fund this sort of activity through the FAST Act, which is a traffic safety bill that was passed during the Obama administration. One is being made available purely to deal with profiling, and the other is available for the improvement of traffic records on the state level. Combined, I anticipate, assuming that we are able to procure both, and we are in process for both, up to about $1.1 or $1.2 million in possible federal offsets per biennium for this project. Finally, just by way of signpost, the Department of Public Safety Standards, Safety and Training, maybe throwing a word in there, DPSST, estimates their preliminary fiscal at about $2.9 million for this project. This is a reflection of the need to educate officers not just at the point that they are at DPSST, but throughout their careers. And because our law enforcement is all over the state, and we are blessed to have a centralized location, you can't have Josephine County come to you. You have to go to them. And that's a real expense driver. So that's just a preview of the significant policy issue that House Bill 2355 presents, and I hope it's to you soon. Chair Winters, now that you've returned, I think we'll revisit briefly House Bill 2500 and try to make the statement requested by the good chair. So I'll ask my colleague to step in.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, my name is Joanne Southey. I'm the Deputy Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division and lead the Child Advocacy Section at DOJ. I was asked to speak to your question, Co-Chair Winters, regarding the lack of a fiscal on House Bill 2500. And I think to explain that, the way the bill was originally written, it included some other members of the public being charged with the obligation to provide that training to the Department of Human Services child welfare caseworkers. As their attorney in those juvenile dependency proceedings, that caused some concern, having an opposing party provide that training. So with some finesse and some switching of the language, that now falls back on the Department of Justice to provide that training. We do some of that training ongoing. What we can do is just actually standardize the training that we provide throughout the state right now, county by county, and just have it be a centralized training that we provide consistently in the course of our normal juvenile dependency representation.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, the only remaining item of legislation that we wanted to highlight, and we'll really take the direction of the committee about whether we should make any sort of a detailed analysis of it now, is House Bill 2345, which is the dependency bill. It's been referenced several times today. But
we had an entire hearing on that. Co-Chair Winters, do you want them to go into that at all?
Not unless there are members who want to hear more about it. That was rather lengthy. Hearing on the juvenile dependency bill. So, no.
All right.
So are those the only three that you have?
Well,
I'm sorry, I was out of the room because I was had to.
Chair Stark, Senator Winters, in the discussion we had coming in, those three, there are other bills that have some bearing on the Department of Justice, but, and we, I believe, checked with staff on this coming into the meeting, many of them we don't anticipate will be coming to this committee. We believe they'll be probably tethered to the Department of Human Services budget and therefore going to the Human Services budget.
Will you move forward to the next slide just so we can look at it real quick?
Yeah, it was.
It might have froze.
There we go.
Oh, wait. Thank you.
There we go.
That's the one.
Yeah, I was wondering what had happened to that.
Oh, you're right. I am sponsoring a lot of those. Whoops.
And Chair Stark, members of the committee, they're all excellent bills.
Thank you very much.
Oh, I see that House Bill 3428.
Hmm. And again, Chair Stark, members of the committee, with the possible exception of Senate Bill 896 and House Bill 2813, both of which 2813 is still in the Rules Committee, and it had been moving. I mean, it's such a recent bill that I don't know that we felt that we were really at the point to discuss it in any detail. But the remainder outside of those I've already highlighted really do look like they sort of universally would be potentially predominantly impacting other agencies. They're impacting DOJ either incidentally to their larger purpose, or we don't think they'll come to the public safety sub. The one exception to that might be Senate Bill 896. Senate Bill 896, if I recall correctly, it was an Oregon Law Commission bill that was designed to do a very technical overview of the processes by which you can challenge certain appellate decisions. And we put an indeterminate fiscal on it. And the only comment I'd make there is the reason that we placed a fiscal on that at all is this bill, which again contemplates additional legal remedies being made for a misentry of a judgment or something similar on a misdemeanor. Whether we have a fiscal would depend completely on decisions made by the by OPDS, the Public Defense Services. We don't anticipate needing to spend any actual money on it now. So that's the only comment I'd make is, while we did put an indeterminate, it's not the sort of indeterminate that I think will require you to give us any money at this time. So I just want to clarify that on the record.
All right. Great. Anything else? Any final questions?
He does reserve the right to come back and ask.
Of course he does. He's there or not. He's allowed. All right. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Aaron, how did 481 turn out? How did 481 turn out? Aaron, how...